The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These articles are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we follow the search for ancient fossils. In this case, we'll be taking a trip to the African nation of Niger to retrieve dinosaur bones from the desert. Such expeditions are not only closely monitored, but also sponsored by National Geographic in order to document and bring to light new findings in scientific exploration. Now, as we're going to hear, writer and explorer Paul Sereno offers us a firsthand account of how to retrieve 55 tons of dinosaur bones from the Sahara Desert. Now, his story was published in the August 2025 issue of National Geographic. An introductory photo caption tells us more. Millions of years ago, what's now North Africa was a lush landscape teeming with an incredible variety of life. To reveal more about the mysteries of this lost age, paleontologist Paul Sereno mounted perhaps the boldest dinosaur hunt ever attempted. His article includes photographs that were taken by Keith Lazinski. So, let's find out what Paul and his travel cohorts have learned. As the Saharan sun rose on my waylaid team one morning in September 2022, it seemed to burn with particular intensity. For nearly 3 weeks, we'd been holed up in a mud-walled compound in the oasis town of Agadez in central Niger, stalled because of officials' insistence on assembling for us a large armed escort. Now, as dawn broke, we were finally ready to embark. Nearly 100 people packed into 15 vehicles, a motley caravan of SUVs, pickups, and one large dump truck, all strapped with sand ladders and spare tires, heading out on an extraordinary desert dinosaur hunt, without question the most ambitious of my career. Among our number were Trowick guides and drivers, a film crew, 64 armed guards, and my paleo dream team of 20 students and freshly minted professors. Recruited to spend 3 months venturing across one of the planet's least hospitable landscapes, our mission was to explore and excavate three distinct sites spread across hundreds of miles, blazing, roadless desert. The fossils we found we would ship to my University of Chicago Fossil Lab for careful cleaning and study, later returning them for a display in Niger to celebrate the country's stunning ancient heritage. I had crisscrossed the Niger's Sahara during 11 previous expeditions going back 32 years. The last two in 2018 and 2019 had been for reconnaissance, and I'd spotted bone-rich pockets in some of the desert's most remote and sand-swept corners with dinosaur skeletons jutting from the desert floor. But without the team or tools to collect them, I could only log the sites and imagine our return trip. Then a global epidemic shut down the world, and I spent 2 years drawing up an audacious plan and fundraising with little success. That is, until a benefactor requesting anonymity agreed to fully fund the request. Now, my appeal had aimed at our innate human curiosity, a chance to uncover creatures from paleontology's last great frontier. Niger is a dino wonderland because of two chance geologic events. The first unfolded 180 million years ago during the early Jurassic, when the great landmass Gondwana began to break apart, forming a massive depression in the center of what is now the West African nation, then a verdant region teeming with life. For millions of years, the depression took in sediment and the skeletons of dinosaurs and other creatures. Now, the second event happened 20 million years ago when a volcanic hotspot raised what's known as the Ah Massif on the edge of this depression, tilting the strata upward and returning to the surface the now fossilized skeletons. Driving across these rock layers today, heading from Agadez into the open desert, is a journey through deep time. Our timeline was ambitious even before the delay in Agadez, and the expedition's success would hinge on benefiting from lessons I'd learned in the past, along with some novel technology we would deploy in the field. Our perseverance would be tested. Many of my young colleagues had never set foot in the Sahara, worked under armed guard in 130-degree heat, or gone a month without a shower. Those with me on the previous expeditions, meanwhile, had seen it all. Food poisoning, malaria, sandstorms, expedition-ending breakdowns, gun-toting bandits, government coups, and yet I am always eager to go back. Now, we're going to continue his story in just a moment, but we want to draw our attention to an accompanying graphic that goes with this part of the article. And it's an insert that tells us a little more about what we're going to be exploring. And it's called A Formidable Fossil Quest, and it says paleontologist Paul Sereno's latest foray into the desert of central Niger covered hundreds of miles on sand track roads. The expedition found his team facing extreme heat, logistical puzzles, and security risk while working to retrieve a remarkable number of fossils. Then there's a little piece on relics in stone near the mountainous region of Air Massif. Rock layers from the Jurassic and Cretaceous periods are rich with fossils of animals and plants that lived in a wetter, greener Sahara. And remember, this is millions of years ago. Then we get into some arduous travels. After trucking and supplies from the capital, Niamey, a group of 100, including guards, to protect against bandits, caravaned into the desert to excavate sites in three remote areas. Sereno later returned to Niamey, accompanying a cargo of fossils. So that gives you a pretty good idea of this thing. It says there were a total of 92 expedition days, and the daily temperature was plus 100 degrees Fahrenheit. They drank almost 8,000 gallons of drinking water and had 55 tons of fossils collected by the end of their journey. So that gives you an overview of what to expect. Now we continue. No one knows the land and its secrets better than those who live on it, and our site near Agadez was a return to a tantalizing find that local Tuareg nomad had shown us. Years before, he led my team by motorbike into the desert to a spot in what the Tuareg called the Chinkankaran, or place of insects, for the locusts that swarm after seasonal rains. It's a gravel rise about 10 feet high that stretches for nearly a mile and a half across the acacia-studded Eraser Desert Plain. Atop the little ridge, a series of large spool-shaped vertebrae breach the surface. Some digging expose more of the backbone, which belonged to a 50-foot-long sauropod, a classification given to long-necked, plant-eating dinosaurs. For this expedition, my team fanned out over the rise and quickly made a series of stunning discoveries, encountering four more of these massive creatures, including one whose neck ended with the most cherished of paleo prizes, a skull. All four seemingly belong to the same yet unnamed species. We nicknamed it iPod, shorthand for Eraser Plain Sauropod. The elevated fossil field, meanwhile, became Sauropod Island. From the details of its skeleton, I suspected our iPod dated to the Middle Jurassic, some 160 million years ago. But without an ash bed to date it by, this was only a guess. Finding a seam of volcanic ash near a dig site is every paleontologist's dream, since crystals within it can contain datable radioactive isotopes. I'd had my eyes out for ash beds on previous expeditions, but like every Saharan explorer before me, I'd come up dry. This time, however, I brought along one of the world's great time tellers, MIT research scientist and isotope whiz, Jahan Ramazani. Now, Jahan's big discovery came by accident after a rock punctured a tire on one of our battered Land Rovers not far from the Sauropod Island. As a few of us set about to repair, he scrambled up the side of a nearby cliff. Soon, Jahan was calling my name, and I found him poking at a greenish clay, an indicator of ancient volcanism to his expert eye. Would that clay contain the crystals we need to date our fossils? Well, Jahan smiled at me confidently. I'll bet my career on this one, he said. Finding bones at Sauropod Island was the easy part. The challenge was whether we could collect all we saw in the 3 weeks we could devote to the site. Most of my team doubted it was possible. 30 years ago, it likely wouldn't have been, but our tools have come a long way. Some of what we bring to the Sahara today still resembles the equipment and supplies from my first foray in 1993. We still use plaster, burlap, and wood to cocoon fossils in portable field jackets. Our Land Rovers are trusty survivors of past treks. We still get by on packets of dehydrated food, although these days, adding boiling water to a package labeled lasagna yields something closer to the real deal. But new gear and technologies have dramatically transformed both the speed of excavation and the imaging of fossils as they emerge. Drill breakers powered by lithium batteries have largely replaced chisels and rock hammers. Lightweight electric jackhammers have replaced picks. GPS and digital imaging technology have replaced hand-drawn maps, while drones and photogrammetry can generate 3D images in minutes on scales that range from sprawling dig sites to individual bones. At Sauropod Island, a drone flying overhead captured the entire scene, our tracks weaving between skeletons like ant trails. I wouldn't say modern equipment makes the work easy, but it does make the job safer and more efficient. Together with good old-fashioned sweat and 15-hour days, it helped our efforts pay off. When we pulled away from Sauropod Island, triumphant and exhilarated, our trucks constrained under a load of some 25 tons of fossils. Even more remote country awaited us at a site called Gaudafeyawa, said to mean a place where camels fear to tread. It is Africa's most famously rich or fossil-rich area in the heart of the Sahara's hyper-arid Tenere region, a desert within a desert. Although I've never felt so much as a drop of rain in Gaudafeyawa, my team made a fossil discovery there years ago that's a reminder of how much wetter the area once was. It wasn't a dinosaur at all, but rather prehistory's largest dinosaur-eating crocodilian, the Sarcosuchus, or Suchus. We call it the Super Croc, a nickname that has stuck with the media. We left from Agadez, where we'd deposited fossils between digs. In front of us, a roadless expanse of rock gave way to a majestic but daunting dunescape, unfolding as far as the eye or drone could see. Experienced local guides are essential in such terrain, where sinkholes of unexpectedly soft sand can mire vehicles driven by even veteran Saharan hands. Our large dump truck, loaded with 1,000-liter tanks of water, was prone to sinking. Digging it out became a familiar routine, extending what could be a single day's journey to Gaudafeyawa into three. You know you've arrived at Gaudafeyawa when you see the fossil bones tinged red with iron, scattered in every direction among the low rocky ridges. We were looking for species that lived alongside Super Croc in the early Cretaceous, some 110 million years ago. Our first target was our Aranosaurus, a 30-foot-long sail-backed herbivore. My team had encountered one years before and had covered it to protect it from wind erosion until we could someday return. We found it again before long, a gorgeous row of plank-like bones, as tall as a human and arranged in an array like a peacock's fantail. It was the first intact bony dinosaur sail ever discovered, and studying it will help solve the mystery of what biological purposes these protrusions served. To make up for our initial delay in Agadez, we worked deep into the night excavating Aranosaurus, relying on generator-powered lamps. Although the work was exhausting, round-the-clock excavation has its perks in the heart of the Sahara. Nighttime temperatures plummeted to half the day's 125-degree high. Insects attracted by our bizarre desert light showed retired before midnight. As all told, we would pack out 2 tons of Aranosaurus fossils in just 3 days. Gaudafeyawa hides its secrets under drifting, shifting sand. You might walk right past a hidden skull one year, only to spot it the next. On an earlier visit, we had discovered a patio-like stretch of exposed sandstone that was packed to a jaw-dropping degree with the embedded bones of raptors, turtles, fish, and more, what paleontologists call a microsite. As I returned to Gaudafeyawa, among the foremost questions on my mind was whether the microsite would be buried under deep sand, and if it wasn't, how we might carve it up and collect it. I held my breath as I neared the spot and saw a towering dune, but miraculously, just yards away from it, the microsite was exposed, and soon it was surrounded by awestruck paleontologists on their hands and knees, marveling at the sandstone-bound menagerie. We used a rock saw with the largest diamond-covered blade we could find to slice down, about 6 inches, into the bone patio, hoping to cut it back into bricks and that we could carry out in our field jackets. But would the slabs separate cleanly? When the first one did, with little more than the rap of a chisel or tap of a chisel, my team whooped. I felt like Michelangelo at first, then like Darwin aboard the HMS Beagle, knowing a million bones of unknown species were ours for the collecting. Painstakingly removing rock or sediment from around fossil treasures like these might require years of lab time. But there at Gatafewa, one of my team members submerged a block from the microsite in water, and we discovered to our amazement that the sandstone matrix softened instantly, meaning this trove could be freed with minimal effort back at the fossil lab. The thrill of that realization helped power us through 6 long days transforming the bone patio into 10 days of jacketed slabs. And there are a lot of photos that accompany this article that they show you the work that they're doing. Next, we headed to our final site with only 2 weeks left in the field, feeling the pressure 3 years before. We'd come to this place some 120 miles east of Agadez after investigating a passage I'd read in a 1950s monograph. Its author, French geologist Hayes Faure, described an isolated site where he had found saber-shaped teeth, I should say, like those of the T-Rex-esque Egyptian predator, Chicharodontosaurus. With some effort, we had found this site, along with it plenty more teeth, confirming Faure's understanding of the beds as late Cretaceous, some 95 million years old. We might have left with nothing more than teeth if not for a serendipitous visitor to our camp. He wore a black trench coat, chachi head wrap, and sunglasses with a Tuareg sword slung over his shoulder. His name was Abdul Manasser, and he offered to take us to a bigger bone field. As he led us deep into one of the Sahara's great ergs, or sand seas, over and between dunes, our Land Rover struggled to keep pace with his Honda motorbike. He was feeling like a fool's errand until Abdul pulled up alongside a thigh bone as long as I am tall. It clearly belonged to a skeleton. In every direction, there was more bone. With little daylight and fuel, we were able only to note the GPS coordinates of the place called Jingibi and grab a few jaw pieces we assumed were from the Cardiodontosaurus. But assembling the jaw back in Chicago, I realized the teeth and tooth sockets were all wrong. They belonged instead to the sail-backed predator Spinosaurus. It was the first record of one of these water-loving beasts found so far inland, and I suspected it was a new species. Our return trip to Jingibi took us back across the erg. We hopscotched among the rocky areas, each smaller than the last, as we traveled deeper into it. We set up camp near where we found the jaw pieces, and we'd been there no more than an hour when my colleague, Dan Vidal, a seasoned paleontologist from Spain, came running toward me, eyes gleaming. "It's here," he said, "the skull." I found much of my team gathered around a toothy snout jutting up from the rock. These were the first Spinosaurus skull bones found in place in more than a century. My colleague stood mesmerized as the significance of the find sank in. Some even wept. A few hours later, Dan found me again. This time he held an unfamiliar boomerang-shaped bone. It was a head crest, we realized, but a strange one, projecting upward to a degree never seen in predatory dinosaurs. And where the crest of the Egyptian Spinosaurus is a ridge, this one was shaped like a scimitar. While the team excavated the skull, Dan, our photogrammetry expert, documented the emerging skeleton with digital photos, a much faster process than in my early career when we'd have photographed a few key fossils and I had stood over others doing shaded drawings. That evening, on a laptop in the tent, he presented us with a 3D image made from the stitched-together photos of the skull of our new tall-crested Spinosaurus. The team was awestruck. It wasn't our last spectacular find at Chinguibi. A few days later, an 11-year-old boy from a Tuareg family camped nearby offering to show us fossils he'd seen while wandering with his goats. Navigating complex terrain he knew by heart, he led us to site after site, some with little more than a lonely bone fragment. At the last site, however, was an impressive set of bones and teeth. The latter's saber-like shape left no doubt we had found Africa's first partial skeleton of a Cardiodontosaurid. After cleaning and assembling, it will provide the first detailed look at Africa's line of these colossal predators. We return to Agadez, haggard, dirty, and triumphant, with fossils filling two 40-foot containers. On a truck scale, the results of our efforts weighed in at 55 tons, twice that many of what we had estimated. I, meanwhile, was 32 pounds lighter. I was also elated, leaving Niger for Chicago and knowing that in a matter of months, our fossils would soon make the same trip. Then one last hurdle arose, suddenly and unexpectedly, a few months after our return. A military coup toppled the elected government of Niger, putting the shipment of the fossils on hold. For nearly 2 years, the fossils from our expedition remained in limbo. Then, this spring, I traveled to Niamey, Niger's capital, where I signed an agreement that will at last bring the fossils to Chicago. It also provides for their staged repatriation, and it establishes a blueprint to develop two new Nigerian museums to house them, along with an institute to train the country's next generation of museologists, archaeologists, and paleontologists. These initiatives will be overseen by Niger Heritage, a foundation I established in 2016. I first came to Niger for its fossils, for high adventure, and for the stark beauty of its landscape and sunsets, but I've returned again and again because of my deeper motivations as a paleontologist, because I know that the significance of my work isn't ultimately measured in new species, but by the impact those discoveries can have on the future of a nation. On the eve of our expedition, I had goaded my young team members by telling them that this would be their chance to write a new chapter in Earth's history, something they'd have few opportunities to do in a lifetime. We now have troves of images, video, and data from the field, and we have presented findings to conferences and journals, including a paper on the remarkable tall-crested Spinosaurus species. Soon, we will have the bones for close study, along with geologic samples to reveal their age. Next will come an outpouring of discoveries related to the Cardiodontosaurus, a dozen new sauropods, a digging raptor, an armless croc, a giant superfish, and other new species. We are poised to write that chapter, introducing others to Africa's lost dinosaur worlds, daring them to imagine what still lies beneath the surface. Wow, sounds exciting, doesn't it? And it's going to probably be another article or two coming in future episodes that we can enjoy their finds and more stories like this one. And along with this story, and included is an explanation of the process of called mapping dinos in the desert. Now, first, we're going to compare the digital site mapping with the older process that's called the traditional site mapping. Now, under digital site modeling, as they say here, in Niger, Sereno and his team relied on tools that stitched together photos to make spatially accurate 3D site models. Less manual mapping meant more time for digging, so they used the modern technology, in other words, to really make things become clearer. Now, the old way, traditional site mapping, paleontologists would set up a grid to plot fossil locations, then measure and draw things by hand. But an artist's angle of view is limited, and the method is time-consuming and less detailed, as you can imagine. And they got a picture here of just someone standing over one of these grids and, you know, mapping out and drawing what they see. Now, we are talking about a 20-day excavation in this example. And these are site models from the Niger expedition, and they got little graphics to go along explaining what they do. Day one is called discovery. The team found fossils on a prior trip to the Eraser Plain, or Eraser Plain, I should say, preserving them from erosion with a plaster cap. In 2022, they returned to excavate the mysterious animals. Now, number two, comes with mapping with photos. Now, hundreds of photos from drones and handheld cameras recorded the excavation's process. Anchor points common to the images allowed the photogrammetry software to connect them. And this is an amazing process. I recently had to go to a doctor's visit, and they used that same process to map out an area that they were going to work on for me for some minor surgery, and took a bunch of photos, put them up on a screen, and stitched them together electronically. I'm saying, wow, that's cool. And that's kind of what's going on here. So you take these individual images, you overlap them, and put them together to get your clearer picture. Next comes excavation. This is step three. The team carefully brushed and chipped away rock and dirt surrounding fossils using hand and power tools. Fossil measurements and positioning data could be gleaned from the digital models. And they had multiple camera angles to look at, and they had different stages that they went through to get here, and of course using all that. Then they had to prepare these bones for transport. This is part of day 12. So 12 days of this 20-day expedition are behind us now. Next, we move to the next step, which is fossil preparation, which takes place in day 20. And they're using aluminum foil, strips of burlap, and plaster to get all this done to allow the wrapping. And they have a wooden brace to put these bones on in order to complete the wrapping. And then finally, we get into fossil modeling. Now, the photogrammetry also let the team make 3D models of individual fossils for virtual study and to envision how an animal might have looked. So quite a process there, but done in a short amount of time, as far as time goes, 20 days. Well, let us continue now, and we're going to talk now as we move from Paul Serrano and his team. We learned that there are many groups of scientists and explorers seeking to study and save once unseen or lost elements of time. We have another example, A Star Among Stars, written by Joel Satari and published in the January 2025 issue of National Geographic. And he tells us about the race to save one of the world's largest sea stars from extinction and how it just got more interesting. The Sunflower Sea Star, which can span more than 3 feet across, is a ravenous, roving apex predator, able to devour armored animals like urchins, snails, clams, and crabs. But a mysterious wasting disease, thought to be worsened by climate change, has led to an estimated global population decline of over 90% since 2013. In a bid to restore these hunters, which range across the northeastern Pacific, West Coast scientists are learning to breed them in captivity. The entire aquarium heard us cheering, says Melissa Torres, senior aquarius at UC San Diego's Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, when her team produced the first fertilized eggs in 2024, following the lead of Washington State scientists. With more than 300 juveniles now growing across six partner institutions, the hope is to one day release the species back into California waters, where it's considered essentially extinct. All this excellent news, unless you happen to be a sea urchin. Again, that written by Jason Battelle and photographs by Joel Satari, and he's one of the explorers as well. And amazing story here about the star among stars as we learn more about sea urchins. Now, my friends, that brings us to the end of today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.